For millions of football fans around the world, Super Bowl Sunday is one of the most exciting days of the year, but few of them realize how much organizing and marketing goes into putting it together. In his new book, The Billion Dollar Game, Wall Street Journal sports writer Alan St. John takes us behind the scenes of a 365-day process that led up to last year's Super Bowl number 42 in Glendale, Arizona. It's published by Doubleday and brings Alan St. John to the show today. Hello.
It's great to be here, Leonard.
And it is ironic that it was in Arizona last year, but this year it won't be in Arizona, even though the Cardinals are in the game.
Actually, what's kind of interesting is that one of the reasons why the Cardinals are going to be in the Super Bowl is because of the stadium that was built to host last year's Super Bowl. I mean, basically, it was the sort of thing where an organization that's been one of the worst organizations in sports, really, over its whole history, all of a sudden kind of did something right almost by accident, made some money from it, and again, just kind of got themselves on the map.
Well, there's a team that started in Chicago, then went to St. Louis, and then wound up in Arizona.
Indeed. One of the things that I found out is back in the day, the reason why they're called the Cardinals is because they got hand-me-down uniforms from the University of Chicago, which was then the Maroons. That's my alma mater. They had maroon uniforms. They'd wear them for a year. They'd launder them. And then they'd hand them down to the professional team. The college team would hand it down to the professional team. That's how far the NFL has come.
Well, Frank Gifford was here a few months ago, and he talked about the 1958 NFL League Championship game between the New York Giants and the Baltimore Colts. And he said that changed professional football forever because it made it more popular. Before then, it was always just a college game. But how popular had pro football been before 1966 when the AFL, I think it was at that time, champion faced the NFL champion?
Exactly. I mean, the thing was, there was a kind of, on the one hand, football was gaining popularity in general. On the other hand, you had this kind of little intramural war between the AFL and the NFL, and they were fighting over players, and there were all these funny stories about how they would literally secret away college players and hide them in rooms and literally, like, have to sneak them out through fire escapes and all sorts of crazy things like that. On the other hand, what you actually found, ultimately what happened was when they decided that they needed to end this war, this must stop here, they decided that, hey, one of the things they needed to do, have a championship game.
This is before they decided to merge?
This was right around, when they decided to merge, one of the things they needed to do was, again, okay, we're going to have a championship game. And this was one of the ways that the Super Bowl sort of came to be. They basically decided to take a game instead of having it in Yankee Stadium or Lambeau Field, somewhere where it's, you know, all about the home field advantage, all about the home crowd. They decided the easy thing to do, you know, in this complex negotiation, was say, okay, we'll have it at some neutral site. It was really a tremendously fortuitous turn of events for the NFL because it allowed them to, unlike the World Series or the NBA championships or any other championships in professional sports, you know where it's going to be even 4 years from now. You know what the date's going to be and you know where it's going to be.
And it's generally a warm weather site or a dome stadium.
Exactly. Well, it has to be one of those two things.
So that means an awful lot of cities will never see a Super Bowl.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, there's never been a Super Bowl in New York, and it's likely to not happen for the foreseeable future because we're not going to have a dome here.
Was the Super Bowl also created in hopes of increasing the popularity of pro football?
Well, again, I don't think that anybody was really planning that far in advance. I think the Super Bowl, something doesn't get to be this big, I think, through planning. I think something gets to be this big almost just through sheer, you know, just happy coincidences. And there's been a long series of them throughout the history of the game.
Actually, there were three Super Bowls before it officially was called the Super Bowl, weren't there?
Exactly. And Pete Rozelle got the name the Super Bowl. Actually, it was a guy from the AFL, one of the AFL owners, a guy named Lamar Hunt, who was really just kind of a wildly interesting guy in his own right.
Well, the son of H.L. Hunt, one of the great Texas oil tycoons. We talked about him earlier on the show.
Exactly. I mean, you know, a really interesting guy and evidently really quite a thinker in a way. And he's watching his kids, and they have this preposterously bouncy ball that's going all over the place. And it's like, well, so what are you guys playing with? And they say, that's the Super Bowl from Whammo. And he says, yeah, that's – and he's jokingly actually puts that up as a name for the game. Pete Rozelle, who is the NFL commissioner, he hated it. He hated the idea. He thought it was just completely undignified. So it was – so officially it was the AFL-NFL World Championship game. And then – and it was only and really only at that third Super Bowl that he basically gave up. Everybody else was calling it the Super Bowl, and it was going to look sort of preposterous for them to call it anything else.
Now, the third Super Bowl could be seen as a turning point because that's the one where the Jets beat the Baltimore Colts, and that was the first time that an AFL team won. Up until then, it was just assumed that the NFL would win year after year after year.
Indeed. I mean, that was a huge thing. And again, part of it was the fact that it sort of took some. The game became bigger than just a football game because here you had Joe Namath. He guaranteed the win, and Joe Namath was not. He was a great football player, but he was really just a great star, and he was a celebrity, and that's really what the Super Bowl has come to be.
Okay, but now let's talk about the first Super Bowl, the first official one, which took place in New Orleans. That was Kansas City against the Vikings. Would we recognize it as a Super Bowl today? Because these things have become giant productions, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean the game itself is going to look a lot the same, but it's really all the stuff around it. It's the fact that it becomes one of the big television broadcasts of the year. It becomes an opportunity for really just sort of a festival, a week-long festival. Part of it, some of it is, kind of grassroots, and a lot of it, is big corporate entities just pouring money and entertaining their very best clients and spending an awful lot of money on them.
Were they doing any of that in New Orleans in 1969?
Yeah, well, certainly not at anywhere the level that they're doing it now.
But at the same time, I guess it was really the start. Did they have the halftime show and things like
they
that?
They had a halftime show, but I mean, back then you were looking at, Carol Channing and Up With People and the Florida A&M Marching Band. Now you have U2, you have Bruce Springsteen, who's doing it this year, you have the Rolling Stones, and it's really just become an entirely different sort of a thing.
And that means a lot of money being spent. I can't imagine the Rolling Stones or Bruce Springsteen are doing it for the sheer joy of appearing at the Super Bowl.
Well, actually, as far as the NFL is concerned, they are. They're actually not getting paid for it. The NFL is covering their expenses, which are, of course, very formidable and, may run into seven figures. But that said, they're not actually getting paid for the appearance. But what they are getting is they have this opportunity to sell an awful lot of records.
Because Bruce Springsteen has a new album coming out.
He does. And he was actually the first one to really sort of take advantage of this fully. I mean, Paul McCartney's back catalog went up like 350%. Prince's back catalog went up 700% in the week, in the week or two after the game. Bruce is really one of the very first to say, hey, we're going to throw a new record out there and we're going to basically get out on the road and use this as sort of a way to launch it.
My guest is Alan St. John, who is the author of a number of bestsellers, The Mad Dog 100 and The Mad Dog Hall of Fame, both with Christopher Russo. You're with the Wall Street Journal right now?
I was working with the Journal up until just a few months ago.
His latest book, The Billion Dollar Game, Behind the Scenes of the Greatest Day in American Sports, Super Bowl Sunday, is published by Doubleday. So what happened between 1966, the first championship game, and now? It went from being a respectable game to this worldwide phenomenon whose, and I'm quoting you, economic impact is greater than the GDP of 49 nations.
Yeah. And when you look at, it's not a billion-dollar game. It's a $2.5 billion game. And there,
Well, when you say, what are you talking about? It's not just the money that's made from people buying tickets. We're talking about its impact on tourism and all the rest.
Talking about its impact on tourism, you're talking about television rights and revenues. You're talking about marketing and merchandising for the league and for the teams and all of that. I mean, it's really, and up to and including some legal gambling on the game. The illegal gambling is even much bigger than that. So it's really, it's a very widespread thing. And it's not something that everybody has sort of spent a lot of time, counting every single penny in this. But whatever it is, it's much, much bigger than $1 billion. And that's, you know, and it's really changed just remarkably in a very short period of time.
How much does it cost to put together? Because you say $1 billion, but you can still spend $1.5 billion to make $1 billion.
Well, the NFL, I mean, you know, that said, you know, the funny thing is it ends up being a lot of this money falls to the host committees in the various cities. They do all sorts of both large infrastructure projects that sometimes get tied to these things the same way they would for an Olympics. And on the other hand, you know, small things like paying for the banners that would go up on all the chain link fencing around the stadium and those kinds of things, the garbage cans. You know, that's basically where the NFL is, you know, running this as a business, making sure that somebody else is paying for it besides them.
And the Super Bowl that you've written about, 43 last year's, was in New Orleans. I'm sure it was seen to some degree as also an opportunity to help New Orleans recover from the devastation that Katrina had wrought.
Well, actually,
bring new tourists in.
Well, actually, it was in Phoenix last year.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This year is
New Orleans?
No, this year is in Tampa. Last year it was in
Phoenix. I'm so confused.
And New Orleans is one of the cities that had been there, sort of an unofficial rotation of sort of warm weather cities that have the sort of infrastructure to support the game. And New Orleans had been one of those cities and had hosted the game numerous times. This year
it's Tampa Bay.
And this year it's Tampa. And Tampa had also hosted it before. It's basically, and with Phoenix, they really were in a situation of, they had the incredible weather. They had the infrastructure in terms of the city, you know, enough resort rooms, enough hotel rooms, that sort of thing, transportation. But what they didn't have is a stadium. The stadium that the Cardinals used to play in, a stadium that was really, you know, it was a sort of second-level college facility. And so when they basically stumbled upon this guy named Peter Eisenman, who's one of the great architects, he works here in New York City, and they basically stumbled upon Peter to build their new stadium. And the reason why they got Peter is not because he's the kind of guy who you'd, you know, drop in the same sentence as a guy like, you know, Frank Gehry or something. On the other, it's simply, he was an absolute, and was and is, an absolute Stones football fan. And he could rattle off all the names of the backfield of the 1947 championship game.
And he has created the ideal football stadium. Here.
It was really sort of an amazing place. And it's, you know, really sort of absolutely state of the art.
Now, you write that the 13 most watched television programs in history are all Super Bowls. What was the first year that happened?
Well, again, I mean, you know, the thing that's really interesting about Super Bowl ratings is that they're remarkably consistent. They don't seem to be really affected by who's playing in the game. I mean, you can have sort of a sort of mediocre matchup. It doesn't really matter if you have, you know, the Rams playing the Titans. A lot of people tune in. It doesn't really matter if the game is close. The game can be kind of a blowout, and you still get plenty of people tuning in.
Who wouldn't normally watch football.
Oh, completely. I mean, the thing is, often somebody will say the real Super Bowl is the AFC Championship game or the NFC Championship game when you have, you know, a team like the Patriots playing, you know, the Indianapolis Colts or something like that in the AFC Championship game. People will say, you know, ponderously, yes, and that this is the real Super Bowl. On the other hand, when people are sort of voting with their pocketbooks, basically a ticket for something like an AFC Championship game, you can get a fabulous ticket for $300. A nosebleed seat for the Super Bowl is going to be $3,000. It's basically literally 10 times what you would pay. And even though the football game may be every bit as good, it's not the Super Bowl.
I'm sure that that when we talk about money being made, it also extends to the local supermarket all over the country because people are buying all sorts of snacks and guests are coming over to many houses. There's a lot of stuff drunk.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, Budweiser sells an awful lot of beer, which is why they take out all of those commercial spots. And, yeah, it's really become this kind of, you know, a national holiday.
Go ahead.
It's become a national holiday in a sort of interesting way. I mean, you look at all the other holidays. Most of the other holidays have some sort of either a religious basis or quasi-religious basis, or they're sort of patriotic. The Super Bowl is kind of none of those things. And most of the other holidays, again, go, you know, they date back an awfully long time. The Super Bowl, really, it's 20, 30 years ago that this idea that you would get people together at your house and have a Super Bowl party, that's a relatively new idea. And it's kind of, and in a way, it's kind of almost an opportunity for people to just sort of kick back, have fun and sort of, you know, get off their diets, eat some guacamole, and, you know, sit and have an excuse to have friends over and watch the big screen TV.
And then there are the official Super Bowl parties. There are who's responsible for organizing the Playboy Fete?
Well, again, there are actually four women who work for Playboy, who, you know, they're sort of unofficial Super Bowl team. And they work literally from the end of before the game. This Playboy party is usually Super Bowl Eve, and as they're literally taking it down as people are sort of thinking about the game on Sunday morning, and that's at a point at which they're sort of debriefing the party and thinking, how are we going to go and make this party better, make it different? And the thing that's, of course, the challenge is, since it's going to be an entirely different city, they're going to have a whole variety of different challenges there.
Do you think there'll be some cutback this year because of the ailing economy?
Well, I think when you're talking about those kinds of parties, Playboy, and again, I was sort of... if you'd said that this was going to happen a year ago, I would have been thoroughly shocked. But Playboy canceled their party. They're going to be, you know, involved as a sponsor in another party, but to have some presence there. But basically, they're not doing their Super Bowl party, which is truly, you know, which is truly shocking. And indeed, you know, in fact, some of the women who were involved in this in the team, there were some cutbacks at the. Cutbacks at Playboy, cutbacks at the magazine and at PEI, and some of them are not going to be, you know, next year may not be with the company.
Well, you said that they worked from year round. What about the Super Bowl itself? How many people does it take to make a Super Bowl run smoothly?
It's really an army. It's probably 20,000 people and maybe more.
They're working 365 days, well, at least in theory, 365 days
a lot of them. Some of them are working, you know, again, 365 days a year, but they're, and some of them are actually working not a year out, but 2 years, 3 years, even 4 years out. And again, I mean, I was in a room in Phoenix where it was a giant conference room with probably 300 people. These guys were pretty much the tip of the iceberg. Every one of these people probably represented anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousand people, in some organization. It's really giant, and it really goes all, you know, it just spreads all the way from, you know, things like Secret Service, on out to the local trash collectors.
Now, the Wall Street Journal has written reports that suggest that sports teams lose money for the local communities. That's not true with the Super Bowl?
Well,
the Olympics sometimes winds up losing money, doesn't it, for the local community?
It's a really, really interesting question, because you can have honest people and people who make legitimate efforts at this. And on the one hand, you'll get somebody, perhaps the host committee will say, there's $500 million worth of local economic impact on this. And you'll find some academics will say there's absolutely none, or there's even negative economic impact. And the point is, and you can sort of say, well, how can you lose $500 million? Well, the answer to this is it's such a complex problem, because essentially this one, a local economy is so big that $500 million can actually sort of be buried in the ebbs and flows from year to year. But ultimately, it's really a question of just accounting thing. One, which things are you going to assign to the Super Bowl and which are you not? And then which is difficult in and of itself, then beyond that you have the additional level of saying, hey, okay, what would have happened if the Super Bowl had not been here? And of course, then you're getting into what people would have done if the Super Bowl wasn't here. And that really makes for a very difficult set of calculations.
Well, I'm sure that the TV network that carries it makes money, because they just simply charge top dollar for the commercials, although they bid very high for these shows. How much does a Super Bowl go these days?
Well, again, I mean, if you won the spots, you know, basically $3 million a spot over the court, you know, which...
For a 30-second or a 60-second?
For a 30-second spot, I mean, which is a huge...
Wow.
A huge hit. And again, if you sort of look at it, you know, the networks, though, that said, they don't bid on a Super Bowl. They bid on the right to be in the NFL and to a part of an NFL rights package. And the interesting thing, of course, is that a Super Bowl, from year to year, it rotates. And it's one of these crazy days where, on the one hand, you have people watching the commercials at home, and on the other hand, you have network executives rooting for their rivals because they expect that if the game does well and the game draws, the ad rates are high, it's going to benefit them next year.
Although there is this, many people believe that sewer lines get overtaxed during the commercial breaks because that's when everybody goes to the bathroom.
Well, again, I love this. There's a whole variety of just Super Bowl myths, and this was one of my favorites. And it turns out that, again, this is one of these things where, you know, occasionally you will get a sewage line break or a water main break during a Super Bowl. And what it actually, the grain of truth in this is that way back in the day, you had a situation, you would have these radio serials. And when you really did have very primitive plumbing systems and public work systems, you occasionally did have, that really did happen a few times, where a bunch of people went to the restroom, and it just overwhelmed the system. Now, however, the other point, of course, about this is, despite what people say, and while local reporters love to report that, the point is, though, most people actually stay at the television so they can watch the commercials, because the commercials are one of the most exciting parts and one of the most controversial parts of the game.
Because ad agencies make special commercials just for the Super Bowl and may, in some cases, never run them again.
Indeed. I mean, in fact, for most of the advertisers, certainly the biggest ones, they say, one, you know, it can't be an ad that we've run before, and they will often take them out of circulation once it's been run once.
John Frankenheimer made a film in 1977 called Black Sunday about a terrorist attack on the Super Bowl. That was 24 years ago, before 9/11. How much of an issue is security at the Super Bowl?
Security is a huge, huge thing. It is really just, the security is as high as it is at any event, up to and including, you know, visits from heads of state and even a presidential inauguration. It has that level of coordination because, again, it's, you know, it is the definition of a target-rich environment. You know, you've already got people at their televisions watching this. And so they have to take this very, very seriously. Some of this you see, you know, you'll see, you know, there's, of course, you know, a perimeter around the stadium. Everyone has to be, you know, everyone has to go through magnetometers as if they were going, on an airliner. On the one hand, beyond that, though, you know, what you don't see, unless you're looking carefully, is there are snipers on the roofs and there are, you know, Black Hawk helicopters and even fighter jets that are basically on alert just in case.
Now, another one of the things that we've heard is that when a team that was from the original NFL wins a championship, the Dow Industrial Average goes up, and if an old AFL team wins, the Dow falls. Well, in this case, both teams used to be in the NFL because the Steelers were moved from the NFL to the AFL. So does that mean that we're guaranteed that the Dow is going to go up next year?
Well, I certainly hope so. And I think there are a lot of other people who certainly hope so, too. It's, again, one of these things that probably was mostly a coincidence. But
it's true.
Well, for a long time, it was probably just a coincidence. It's the equivalent of maybe a flipping a nickel and getting, you know, heads 11 times in a row. Well, you know, it certainly can happen. But it doesn't say anything about the coin. It doesn't necessarily say anything about your flipping, because you might get tails 11 times in a row the next time, and it balances out. But that said, at a certain point when it became public knowledge, all of a sudden, people were looking at this as sort of the ultimate. It was like outsider information. It wasn't insider information. It was outsider information. It was something like, okay, I know who wins the Super Bowl. I can see this trend. And so people started acting on it, and it would actually see increases in the volume of trading specifically just before and just after the Super Bowl, as people were buying and selling based on this. So it's really kind of an interesting thing.
Well, it'll be interesting to see it in this year, considering the downturn. We have very little time left, but have we missed a point of great trivia in this discussion? Because you have a lot of trivia in this book.
Well, one of my favorite ones is the guacamole question. I mean, you can take 49.5 million pounds of guacamole, and I saw two different numbers. One, that it would fill a stadium up about 10 feet deep, and then I would see that it was actually 20 feet deep, and I would see these numbers bouncing around, and I'm tried to actually get to the bottom of it. And it turns out that the avocado growers, wanting to make this seem that much bigger and that much more exciting, they said, hey, we'll do it. That 19 feet is not the guacamole, but the avocados that go into the guacamole. So you have the pits, you have the skins, and you have the space.
Alan St. John's latest book is about guacamole and other things. It's mm-hmm. called The Billion Dollar Game, Behind the Scenes of the Greatest Day in American Sports, Super Bowl Sunday, published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
On tomorrow's show, Larry Wilmore of The Daily Show shares what he calls his black thoughts, from why black people don't see UFOs to his desire to replace the term African-American with chocolate. Also, find out how robots are transforming modern combat. Then we take a look at Terre Haute, Edmund White's new play, plus our latest underreported. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Stephen Valentino. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Angela Sheldon, Alex Ambrose, Jesse Maple, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening.